Welcome to the Better with Purpose podcast. Thanks for joining me. I'm Michael Plater Finley. Where does our food come from? And how does it make its way to our plates? For many of us, as we've become more and more accustomed to the convenience of buying food, we've become less and less connected to its source. We place a lot of trust in the companies and countless people who play a role in the food industry, but increasingly, consumers are wanting to know more about the origin of their food and questioning the practices that bring that food to us. In this episode of Better with Purpose, I speak with Ben Cullen, the founder of Cullen's Foods. Ben's take on transparency in the food industry drives his dedication to being straight with his customers and his commitment to sustainable, organically grown beans. The Better with Purpose podcast is about people who have built their work around purpose. People committed to making a positive impact on the world through their endeavors, whether that's through business, a not-for-profit organization, a community group, or other forms of creating social good. I invite my guests to share their stories, their journey to finding purpose, what that purpose means to them, how it fuels their work, and how others can find that same kind of meaning and drive for themselves. My hope is that these stories will inspire you to seek out your own purpose in work. And now, my interview with Ben Cullen. Thanks for joining me, Ben.
Gladly. Well, thank you for having me on. I think about our chance meeting on Reddit. And here we are. Lots happened since then, so I'm happy to revisit again.
Ben, could you tell me about Cullen's Foods and how it's a purpose-driven endeavor?
Sure. So, I mean, I think it's one of those things. It's sort of like meeting with a stranger on Reddit and you become friends and there you are on a podcast. You look back and it all kind of makes sense. One thing leads to another. But it's sort of the culmination of a life experience that leads to a business that, frankly, on the surface is totally unglamorous. It's a canned bean business, but it really does kind of define everything that I've done up to this point. And my purpose in it and what I use it as a vehicle for is really just demystifying the food business to consumers and even to farmers that I work with, because I've had the privilege of sort of touch points along the value chain. And my purpose is to just share that with people. So that's the purpose. And the business is canned beans.
So I'm a fan of your beans. And I feel lucky that I got to watch you as you were starting up your business. And watching you build that from scratch was really exciting, just sort of being on the sidelines, because you clearly had this drive to do a thing that was about making a change for something that you had intimate experience with before. And you didn't seem to have any impediment to taking action. I mean, I can't speak to the experience of actually starting the business, but in watching you, you seemed very focused and really clear about the things you needed to do to bring your product to market.
I guess I was. And I came at the entrepreneurial aspect of all of this from very much a position of privilege, in the sense that I made sacrifices, but they were sacrifices I could afford to make. And understanding sort of the steps from A to C to D to Z were clear, just because I think I had, perhaps by fluke, the right experience to know kind of what it takes to get a product to market. And it was a matter of just sort of connecting the dots. So when it came together, I don't remember being too disoriented along the way. And I guess you're right. In a sense, it did come together relatively cleanly in those early days. And we've iterated since then, for sure.
I feel a certain sense of joy on your behalf every time I go to the grocery store and I see your product on the shelf. you know, just knowing, like, hey, there's somebody that has done a thing and their product is there. It's manifested. It's so cool.
There is a certain satisfaction, I have to admit, to walking into a Loblaws or even an independent and finding it there. Yeah. And knowing I got to be involved in every stage of that. And what's unique about it is, I mean, really, every stage, right back to the planting of the crop, which is sort of essential to the whole brand story, I guess. I tend to be, I think, a little bit glass half empty. When you're in it every day, all day, it's like there's always another problem to solve. But I think I need to give myself more of those moments, like what you described, to just see it there manifested and say, oh, holy smokes, it happened. It's there. People are buying it.
Yeah. Yes. I think it's really important to reflect on the achievement and reflect on the journey that brought you to that achievement. Could you tell me about that journey?
It all kind of, it was a series of accidents, really. And I think it starts with my decision to go to agriculture college. I graduated high school in the throes of a financial crisis. And I was a miserable student. Basically, my options were go back to high school or, you know, choose from an array of college programs. And it was kind of, I don't know if this is like millennial parenting. They'd said, you know, your ultimate destiny is you got to go to university. Like, you have the potential, but you got to, there needs to be some finishing, right? So I kind of chose almost at random my finishing school to be agricultural college, which is a little bit unique for a kid who grew up in the suburbs of Toronto. And my family is tangentially connected to ag. My dad and my grandfather were both in horticulture. Dad got out of the nursery business when I was basically a child. So, you know, I really grew up more in a media branding kind of family than in a practical agricultural family. And I chose agriculture college kind of on a whim because I didn't want to go back to high school. So I just applied, thinking at the time, hey, we're in this global crisis, and it seems to me like people are always going to have to eat. And that was basically the instinct at 17 that took me to an agriculture college of 600 students in a town of roughly 4,000 people. So it was a strange time. I mean, to get out of my greater Toronto area bubble and go to enroll in this program where it was me and one other guy out of 100 something students in my year who did not come from a farm. And by graduation, it was just me. The other guy, I think, probably got wise to what late at the end, which, you know, the program was really tailored to farm kids going back to the farm, and I had no farm to go back to. So, you know, by then I was ready to go to university, where I did a business degree out east. And through the co-op program there, I ended up at a consumer packaged goods company. And that was sort of the last stepping off point when I had sort of like an early onset, I call it quarter life crisis, and decided to peace out and go traveling for 3 months before I came back. And I took up kind of a casual role working with my dad, selling gardening products and writing for the media about gardening, drawing mostly on my experience in agriculture. I'd been doing that for a couple of years when the pieces for Cullen's Foods started to fall into place. So I say, you know, it's sort of esoteric experiences lead to an esoteric endeavor. And that's where this unique path of kind of being the only guy in the room full of farmers who wasn't a farmer really kind of forged the opportunity. And I didn't even know it at the time.
Right. You and I have spoken in the past about your experience in CPG and what created that feeling for you of wanting to do something different. Can you tell me some more about that?
Yeah, I think, well, it's partly personality and temperament. It was a business that's in an industry that I'm passionate about, which is food. But I just simply I'm kind of unemployable, Michael. So thankfully I had that realization before they did and cut me loose. But it was a fabulous experience working there, learning the ins and outs, but also realizing that there is opportunity where, you know, it seems to be so dominated by these massive faceless players. Well, there are people behind those faceless corporate fronts, brands, and they operate as such. And, you know, there are also people on the other end who are buying, and they have unique demands. And just understanding that it's not actually as complicated as it looks, and understanding that there's a gap between what people want and what's being offered was sort of the realization that there is an opportunity in this very mature, very slow growth, very big business industry.
Right. So a few things in there that I can connect with personally. So for a start of my career, I worked in advertising. And I really loved doing the creative work, working on a whole range of different advertising things for different brands. There was a part of it that was really exciting because it was creative work. But there was always this lingering thing for me that I was contributing to something that I didn't feel, I guess, ethically sound about. And I felt really conflicted about that because I was being a creative person, doing a thing that I felt good doing, but the output of my work was actually potentially hurting people. And I felt really uncomfortable about that. Do you connect at all with that in terms of, you know, your work in CPG?
I do on a level, for sure. Selling flour for baking moments and memories, you know, some of the, you would know a lot of the marketing kind of thinking behind those products. I don't find them overly offensive. I don't feel necessary. I can see something like a credit card or in real estate where it's so fraught with moral dilemmas, the cost of housing right now. I'm reluctant to equate necessarily big with evil. I think what I wanted was to just pull back the curtain, because actually, I think for the most part, there's sort of mysticism around big brands. And my belief as a consumer is that people just want to know. People just want the feeling that you're being straight with them. I just had sort of a different idea around how we should be communicating with people. My feeling always is I just want people to be straight with me. And as the purveyor of my own brand, I can pull back the curtain and say, look, this is how it gets made. This is who grew it. This is who processed it. And this is the cannery that I don't own that cans the beans. In that sense, I knew I needed to break out, not to necessarily change or defy or undermine the industry, but just kind of do it on my own terms in a way where I could be totally transparent with people. Because maybe it's just a matter of I'm very poor at keeping secrets.
Right. And that's something that, not being poor at keeping secrets, but your transparency in your product is something that from our earliest conversations, I remember you talking about how you really wanted to make it clear where the product came from and how it made its way to your consumer.
Yes, totally. And I think as far as big business and the language of big business, you know, one of the things that I keep on my desk is Politics and the English Language, George Orwell, right? And, you know, he talks about what to look for in language that basically denies accountability. And of course, he was the OG anti-fascist, but you know, we live now in an age where I feel big business is so powerful. And I think generic language and obfuscation is really dangerous. And I think consumers are developing an allergy to it, but there is an entrenchment of big business where you can kind of deploy these terms that mean nothing, right? And that doesn't sit right with me. So, you know, why did I choose canned beans? Well, again, I'm not picking on any brands here, but when I pick up a can of beans and I turn it over, it says product of domestic and imported ingredients. There's two ingredients, it's beans and water, unless they're adding firming agents, colorants and salt, whatever, which I don't do. But, you know, if you're buying a clean deck can of organic beans, there's two ingredients, beans and water. What do you mean domestic and imported ingredients, right? What does that mean? Tell me where it comes from. Like that just, to me, red flag, right? Canada's like the number two exporter pulse in the world. So where are we importing it from? Well, when you pull back the curtain, I mean, thankfully I had the facilities and sort of some of the background to know, well, if they're with organic beans, a lot of them come from China and Turkey or, you know, other trading nations that might not even produce a lot of pulses. So you have country of origin, China organic beans in the Canadian market. That raises some very valid questions. Of course, that's obfuscated by vague language, which goes back to politics and English language, specificity of language. So, you know, to me, I just think you have to respect people's intelligence and you have to produce the thing that you expect to be served and be straight with people. So that is just, that's what really gets me excited is being able to put that out there.
I hear a lot from people about this growing mistrust of the food industry generally. And having had, you know, some experience working in the food industry, although like not from a producer standpoint, but, you know, I got to see a lot of the people who are working on product. And there's what you have said a couple of times now is that, you know, pulling back the curtain. I think it's really important for people to understand that there's not necessarily like malicious things that are going on in the production of food. But it's maybe a situation of like death by a thousand cuts. In that, you know, you don't really know, like you say, when you're buying that can of beans, where those beans have actually come from, let alone like its route to getting to a consumer. It's not any of the individual decisions, but it's sort of like when you start thinking about all the little things that added up to this mystery of, you know, what am I actually, like, I didn't go to my personal garden to pull this out of the ground and make a soup with it. You know, yeah. I'm operating in this sort of bubble of trust of I go to my local grocery store and I pick up the thing and it's going to be something I can trust and feel good about. But, you know, I think the nature of delivering food in the way that it gets delivered to us, you know, through these massive systems means that like further and further depersonalization, more and more disconnection happens between what came out of the ground and what makes it onto your plate. Yeah. And like you're saying, that some people are really not okay with that anymore.
I just naturally am going to spend a lot of time thinking about this stuff. So I could try and manifest it in my business, and some of it takes, some of it doesn't. But I fully agree. And I think what you're maybe getting at is the commoditization of everything, right?
Yes.
And I mean, beans are the ultimate commodity crop. So, you know, when you buy as a wholesale buyer, you don't buy based on origin, you buy based on a standard set of grading criteria. And as a small business person, something I've gotten quite passionate about is the idea of antitrust and industry consolidation, how toxic it is to creativity and entrepreneurship. But this kind of ultimate test of everything that's gotten us here is kind of the consumer welfare test around pricing, right? So basically, as long as prices don't go up, we don't have an antitrust problem here. Thank you very much. Goodbye. And I think we're stopping and realizing, especially with respect to tech, that just because something is free doesn't mean that it's good for the consumer. You know, so when we look at social media, for example, you know, there is issue with the commoditization of our very selves. And I think people are starting to develop an allergic reaction to that. And so that's exactly what I'm trying to do, really, is disaggregate, decommodify commodity product, because, you know, food is very personal. It's something people put in their bodies. And beans are pulses are really interesting when you start to unpack that and our future and the environment and health. But here's an opportunity to take the ultimate commodity, a can of beans, and decommodify it. And that is really resonating with people in a way that I didn't think it would.
When you hear people talking, like talking to you as customers about the things that you feel are important about your product, what does that do for you?
I have a hard time engaging with just a lot of noise. But when people talk to me about what they buy, where they buy it, what they want to know, what they think about when they're preparing their meals, you know, their emotional connection, but also their legitimate concerns, I'm fully engaged in listening, because that to me is important and it's underconsidered, especially in a retail environment where it's just about price and market share and retail domination. So that is how I know that it's kind of my passion or my purpose, is that I'm generally not that always that engaged until it comes to this sort of obscure subject. I'm always curious, where do you buy your groceries? And seeing that piece of the picture come together is like, for me, really invigorating. And it's cool to have a vehicle that I can kind of shape to people's inner thoughts and motivations as I develop a better and better understanding. But it's one of my favorite parts of the business, is talking to consumers, for sure.
Back when I was working in advertising, working on campaigns, and really like the only insights that were provided to us through the creative briefs were three sentences about who the consumer was. You know, really, we had very little idea about who the person was. And we were coming up with, you know, messaging and all these, you know, creative ideas that were based on like our best guess and not necessarily founded on like going, you know, to a grocery store and having a conversation with somebody who's looking at a can of beans and saying to them, hey, what are you going to use that can for? You know, what do you always buy this brand? Is this your favorite brand? Why do you buy it? I feel that the emotional component of food sometimes gets lost.
It does. Or I find, and this is in marketing and politics, broad strokes, is often where we haven't taken the time to understand the consumer or the voter, whoever, and what their emotions truly are. We're stoking negative emotions. Food can be marketed 100 million different ways, but often, especially where organic products are concerned, you're stoking a lot of fear and health concerns from people. And then you're responding with kind of generic messaging, right? Which I find, so on the one hand, you're getting a negative emotion invoked, and then you're getting kind of a generic solution to that problem, which I think consumers are wise. I generally really respect their intelligence. Not generally, I totally respect their intelligence. They know that they're being kind of taken, right? Whereas, you know, my goal is not to stoke negative emotions. It's just to say like, here, this is what I'm doing. You're intelligent. These are all of the facts, and you can take it or leave it.
Right.
And I think that's just, you know, I want to be treated with respect and I don't want to be manipulated. And so that's sort of my mission in this business, is to just give people the facts so they can make an informed decision. And you don't get that very often.
I wanted to come back to about your purpose, and sometimes people lose sight of the reason that they're doing what they're doing. And especially when you are, you know, in the midst of launching and growing a new business, there's so much to tend to. Do you find that you're ever overwhelmed by all of that? And do you ever feel like you lose sight of the thing that you're trying to achieve?
I think because the response to my promise has been so positive, I think I know, you know, it's pretty unwavering that if I was to step away from that promise to try and, you know, for example, there's cost pressures on my business. It's an expensive way to run it. But I think I know that top line would slip away so fast because I would just become like everybody else. And I have the privilege of doing what I'm doing because I'm not like everybody else. So when it gets, you know, when the going gets tough and there's a temptation to cut corners, it's sort of third rail for me because I just know that my license is conditional. So I have to be fully accountable. And I see this going to zero if I start to compromise on that. But I also have the benefit of not being, you know, part of a publicly traded company. I have no external shareholders. My goal isn't necessarily to be a profit maximizing firm. I think the profit maximizing firm is how we get to the situation that we're in with a lot of the problems which we describe. I'm really only, you know, accountable to the consumer and then at the end of the day, myself. So as long as we're breaking even, that serves my purpose and my mission. And that makes me a lot happier than, you know, running a quote unquote profit maximizing firm.
Do you think that a business can be retrofitted to be purpose oriented in the same way that you have started a business with purpose?
That's a good question. I do think so, you know, and actually businesses ultimately are the sum of the people who are involved with them and touch them. And I think, you know, as long as the proprietors are living with purpose, it's going to, I've never met an entrepreneur whose DNA wasn't thoroughly baked in.
Does your purpose in work, does that have an impact on the rest of your life?
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's changed the way I eat. It's changed the people I talk to. I wouldn't know it any other way. It was the same for both my parents. And that's the one thing I guess that I have in common with a lot of the farmers that I deal with is their work is their entire identity. Literally, they refer themselves as farmers. Right. So in that way, yeah, totally. And I think it'll be hard, you know, if this business ever has the opportunity to scale, not being too egocentric about my DNA in the business. I, you know, because ultimately I try and be humble and it's about my interpretation of what the consumer wants. And as other people join this business, it's going to have to be about, you know, as a leader, I guess, of my interpretation of what works for the people who are in this business, you know, in service to the end customer. So that's constantly up for reinterpretation. But yeah, I think definitely it's affected my personal life positively.
Have you had any surprises in starting the business or in how things have unfolded?
Yeah, I mean, there's constantly surprises. I'll tell you, this is not a story that a lot of entrepreneurs would share, but we're having an issue right now. And this is spirit of transparency, but we have an issue with the navy beans where we don't use any firming agents. So a lot of canned beans, you'll see calcium chloride on the ingredient deck. We don't use them. And the reason we don't is because from the people I've talked to, they want as few additives as possible. So we only add beans and water. And the challenge with navy beans is they're really delicate. And when you're canning, in the canning process, you soak and you cook under pressure. The navy beans can lose their starch, which turns to gel. And you end up with this mushy bean paste. It's very, maybe say unpalatable, but it's perfectly safe.
Right.
We had one bad batch that we didn't even put out because it was just terrible. And I donated everything. It was a total write-off. Well, we had a lot code with some broken beans at the bottom of the tote, which much has gotten through. And now we have some mushy beans in market. Okay. Big problem for an entrepreneur. You talk about trust. Well, nothing destroys trust like opening a can of beans. That's just mush, right? And I mean, it's not the product of malevolence. When I have the opportunity to explain that to people, they say, oh yeah, okay, I see what happened here. You know, I value the feedback that I get from consumers more than anything. And I've had three really gracious people reach out. And I say the surprise is just how gracious people have been. And I say, you know what? I'm so sorry. I'm not trying to get anything by you. These are not below grade or whatever. They're safe to eat. This is what happened. And two out of the three people who called me refused a refund. They just said, oh, well, now that you explained it, that's fine. You know, don't worry about it. I support what you're doing. I think it's great. And I appreciate you took the time. And you get these phone calls and it's pit of your stomach, right?
Yeah.
You're kind of in your mind. You have all these furious people on the other end. And I'm sure there are some, But the ones that have taken the time have been just so absolutely lovely and understanding and see, hey, this is a guy who's, you know, I think working in good faith and stuff happens. And so they're $3 or $4 on a can of beans, but you know, that they're willing to share in that misfortune and just say, hey, well, you know, I hope you get it sorted out. Don't worry, I'll buy it again next time. That has just been like the ultimate awakening for me in the last couple of weeks.
I think consumers are so much more forgiving when they know that a person, not some faceless entity, not some like machine, made a mistake and took responsibility for it. And I think like one of the things that I find worrisome about how many layers there are between us and a lot of the products that we get is that, you know, we get to this point where like the facelessness is a little bit like, well, it's a little bit like commenting on the internet, right? Throw out the worst of themselves because yeah. they're angry or frustrated or whatever. And there's no real repercussion. It's not like you would be in somebody's face. I'm not sitting in your living room telling you, I hate your product. When you've got a human in front of you who says, I'm sorry, and I'm going to do something about it. You know, there's so much connection that's created there and trust. You know, when thinking about meaningful human connections, when it comes to getting to know your customers, how have you developed those?
I think part of it is, you know, one, you get to a certain scale, and even if it's 0.1% of consumers take the time, well, we're in almost 600 stores now, 0.1% is material.
Right.
And when that 0.1% of people reach out, it's about picking up, and I read everything and I respond to everything at the present intake. And there's been some spontaneous quasi-professional friendships there, right? You know, it's my parents were both independent retailers back when you had your independent proprietors selling goods. Independent retail was like these little minor community hubs where you got to know your regulars, right? That's maybe another surprise is my brand's just out there. You can get it at national retailers. There's a very special person who knows there's a person behind that and takes the time to even follow us on Instagram. That's great. But, you know, email me. I was emailing at 10:30 p.m. last night with a consumer in Alberta who was telling me about her journey with natural food and her care for the environment and the companies that she's bought from. And we're just emailing back and forth. And it kind of felt like, you know, going to my mom's knitting store when I was after school, one of her regulars had come in to show her what they'd made with the yarn that they bought at her store, right? And that's what where my mom really got her charge in retail. And it's kind of cool that I've been able to kind of have that experience, albeit virtually and dispersed, with this little endeavor.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the things that's really exciting about this time in history is that you can be in Ontario and you can be creating a product that makes its way to Alberta, and you can have a meaningful conversation with somebody who is so far away from you. And, you know, that distance becomes immaterial and you're connecting about, you're not, I mean, from the sense of that conversation, it's not a connection that's simply about like, tell me about your product. It's a little bit more like, tell me who you are.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, really remarkable.
Yeah, it is. And at some point, I'm going to have to disentangle me from the brand, right? Because every entrepreneur goes through this, and then you end up crestfallen when you inevitably have to retire or sell or go bankrupt. And I don't want my ego to become too tied up in it. So I try and separate the two as much as possible. But the fact is, you know, as mentioned, is the fingerprints are all over it. And I think about my business is just a nexus of relationships. You know, it's where the farmers get contracts. It's where the trucking companies get coordinated. It's where, you know, the cannery gets their specs and their volume projections, which are based on relationships with the distributors and the customers and retailers, you know, and I get to sit in this at this nexus. A lot of times, I don't know if everybody involved realizes that they're part of that chain or part of that hub, but I see it clearly. And I celebrate the opportunity to bring people together. And I do that with my growers. We have growers meetings every year. And it's really the highlight of my social calendar is getting all the farmers in a room so they can talk, you know, what worked for them, what didn't. And, you know, there's usually some beers involved. And that's really cool.
Can you tell me about why you commit 1% of your sales to share?
So it's actually really funny because you sent me some questions and I looked at the last question. It was who or what inspired you to seek out purpose in your work? And the obvious answer is my father, my grandfathers, and my mother, who are all entrepreneurs, obvious. But there was actually another person that I wanted to insert there, and that's this married couple, Les and Mark Frayn, who I feel really live with purpose. Unfortunately, we lost Les a couple of years ago. Mark still alive, a retired banker and a retired teacher who were so committed to Share Agriculture Foundation. Now, I say banker and teacher, they were also farmers. They lived on a farm. And I always say to my wife, I mean, they really had the model relationship in terms of living with purpose, because they shared this project, which was Share. And so Les traveled with Share all over Central America. So farmer to farmer, he's an Ontario farmer and a banker, and his purpose, and Mark's continuing with this work, is to lift up farmers in other parts of the world. And that's what Share does. You know, you go to a place like El Salvador, where there's so much trauma and strife, you know, and also, you know, now the global South is on the front lines of climate change. So you have these subsistence farmers whose livelihood is precarious in almost every possible way socially, and they're faced with this existential environmental threat of climate change. And so Share will do things like soft skills training, like hard skills in terms of math and literacy. They fund a lot of scholarships, but they teach about femicide in communities where that's a huge, it's an unthinkable problem for us. But they also invest in infrastructure. So for facing down a problem like climate change, Share will invest in irrigation systems so that farmers can irrigate their land as rainfall becomes less and less reliable with the change in climate, which means that they can stay where they are and where they've been for generations, which means that they can stay in their rural communities, improve their lives, rather than, which is far too common, you know, leaving their communities, going to the cities where there's no opportunities. Young people often end up in gangs, or, you know, making that very dangerous trek to try and emigrate. So there's a lot of kind of very difficult dynamics playing out in a part of the world that's easy for us to ignore. There's some pretty really profoundly effective solutions that are being implemented by organizations like Share. And it's a couple like Les and Mark Frayn who have the conscientiousness, the wherewithal, and the goodwill to make that their life's work. And this was, you know, their life's work in retirement. They would spend months every winter monitoring projects, administering funds. So I'm extremely passionate about that organization and the money that we're able to contribute. But I'm also very inspired by, you know, the people behind it and the purpose that they've had in their life. Very, I would say, rich, satisfied, and inspiring individuals. So that's my story.
Do you have any parting thought on what you might say to somebody who's interested in creating their own purpose-driven endeavor?
I think there's a temptation to look at people who maybe you perceive as having accomplished what you want to accomplish. But I think, you know, don't be too literal in those explorations. What worked for them might not work for you. You know, mileage may vary, but the important thing is to look at, I think, your own unique life experience and interpret that, you know, against the world. And you'll end up with a very different purpose than the people around you. And it involves a bit of creativity and a bit of risk taking, but it's totally worth it.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of Better With Purpose. My conversation with Ben Cullen gave me a lot to think about when it comes to my relationship with food and the importance of listening to customers. I've posted more content related to this episode on the show website, betterwithpurpose.com. Please be sure to check it out and join the mailing list. I'll be sending out updates about upcoming episodes and links to content related to purpose-driven endeavors. My intention with this podcast is to feature a wide range of people who are working to make their lives and others better with purpose. If someone whose story about working with purpose has inspired you, please let me know. I'd love to hear about it. You can email me at michael@betterwithpurpose.com. If you like this episode, please share it with a friend. Thanks for listening.